From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. We're going to talk today about the civil war in Yemen and the horrific humanitarian crisis it spawned. Now, one way to capture the scale of the catastrophe is to think about the cholera epidemic in the country. The cholera has been around for centuries, and dying from it is a really horrible way to go. In severe cases, you basically have such profuse diarrhea and vomiting that your body becomes so dehydrated it can't function and shuts down. Now, the good news is that cholera is treatable with the right medicines, and it's pretty easy to prevent people from getting it. It's usually spread by bacteria and fecal matter contaminating drinking water, so heading it off is just a matter of keeping sewage separate from water sources. So it speaks to the scale of Yemen's problems that right now it's in the midst of the largest outbreak of cholera ever measured in a single year. Now, according to the WHO, there have been nearly 700,000 cases in a country of just 27 million just since March. Now, the reason there's cholera in Yemen is because the country's 2.5-year civil war has destroyed much of the infrastructure in what was already the poorest country in the Arab world. Now, there are a few different actors in this war, including Al-Qaeda, but the two main antagonists are the Houthis, a Shia group backed by Iran and allied with former President Ali Abdullah Saleh, and the mainly Sunni Muslim forces loyal to Yemen's Saudi-backed President Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi. Now, in a few minutes, we're going to hear more about the war and the humanitarian crisis in Yemen from a panel of experts, including about the U.S.'s role in this fight. But first, we're going to talk about the challenges of just getting good information about this conflict. And for that, we're going to bring in Sharif Mansour in Washington. He's the Middle East and North Africa Program Coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists. Sharif, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, tell us, if you would, how did most Yemenis get their news before this civil war happened, and how has that changed?
Before the civil war, there was several steps in which the media have suffered a lot of restrictions throughout the period when we started at CPJ documenting press violation. Yemen was, and in many ways continue to be, one of the poorest, least connected to internet countries. And under Saleh, President Saleh, who was removed in 2011, there were a lot of censorship, a lot of threats against journalists. However, there weren't a lot of casualties among the journalist community. It wasn't until the Arab Spring, where a lot of journalists risks in covering the anti-government demonstrations, that we started seeing independent critical media flourish for a brief period between 2011 until 2014. There was, for the first time, a real contested election, a political process, until this political process collapsed and the houses started taking over the capital in 2014. And one of the first few things that they wanted to show their control and power to do was to cut internet, censor websites, critical websites, and go after critical journalists who were covering anti-Houthi demonstrations. And over the period of 2015 to 2017, the civil war have created one of the biggest divide in the media communities. A lot of the people who are covering the ongoing events have to ally with one of the competing forces, and many of them can only have access if they were...
So in other words, it sounds like the news has become factionalized in Yemen. Either you're with the Houthis, this rebel group backed by Iran that captured the capital, or you're with sort of the forces of President Hadi and his Saudi allies. There's not much middle ground.
Or critical and independent media, let alone international media, allowed in freely to operate.
And if I understand correctly, your group says there are 13 journalists that have been killed in just 2 years.
Since 2015, yes. And they are divided almost equally between the Houthis, the Saudi-led coalition, and other militant and Islamic terrorist groups.
So you do make it sound like the conditions there are very difficult for independent Yemeni journalists. What about foreign journalists and international journalists operating in the country? What's the situation like for them?
Many of them have complained that they were promised and have not been given access. Some have managed to smuggle themselves through other entry points that are controlled by the Saudi coalition or through humanitarian workers that were sent by the UN and were allowed some access at some point. And some were not very lucky, like an American journalist who was killed in 2014 while being in a rescue attempt by American Marines.
Now, there is a Yemeni journalist that I understand your group is honoring this year named Afra Nasser. Tell us about her.
So Afra is an example of how the media landscape have changed in Yemen. She was one of the young missing voices who felt empowered at the end of former President Saleh to express herself online, to build her own blog, and she wrote in English, in many ways providing independent coverage of what's happening in Yemen. And it wasn't until after Saleh was removed from power in 2011 that she felt that she can write a lot more of the stories she wants to do. So she wrote about human rights, about women rights, about a lot of the grievances people have had under former President Saleh. And that caused her a lot of threats to her life, to her family life. So she had to escape as early as May 2011 outside of the country to live in Sweden. But she didn't stop working, and she continued covering more of the, not just the grievances and the humanitarian issues, but also press freedom issues, defending journalists who get into trouble, who do not have a voice or were forced to silence inside the country. And that's why we're giving her our award this year, to not just recognize the difficulties that Yemeni journalists overall are facing, but also a large community of exiled journalists that were forced out of the Middle East after the Arab Spring, and many of whom under threat not just by governments, by non-state actors and militia groups.
Well, Sharif Mansour of CPJ, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Global Journalist. On today's show, we're talking about the war and humanitarian crisis in Yemen. We just heard from Sharif Mansour of the Committee to Protect Journalists about the difficulty of getting good information about the conflict there. Now, to broaden our discussion, we're going to bring in three other guests who are tracking the situation in Yemen closely. Joining us from Dubai is April Longley Ali. She's a senior analyst on the Arabian Peninsula for the International Crisis Group. In New York is Christine Beckerly. She's a Yemen researcher for Human Rights Watch. And in Cambridge, Massachusetts is Stephen Caton. He's a professor of contemporary Arab studies at Harvard University. Welcome to all of you. April Longley Ali, let me start with you. You've been traveling to Yemen just since 2004. Give us just a picture of what the country was like before this war started and maybe how it's changed a bit.
Well, when I first went to Yemen in 2004 as a student of Arabic, it was quite different. It was that period of time in the Arab world writ large where it was prior to the Arab Spring. So Ali Abdullah Saleh was solidly in charge of the country, or so to speak. It was always a negotiation with the tribes and the various other factions in Yemen that he was juggling. He is known for saying that ruling Yemen is like dancing on the heads of snakes. So Saleh and his party were, again, solidly in charge of politics. It was a unified country. Prior to 1990, there was the People's Democratic Republic of Yemen in the south, and there was North Yemen. They were united in 1990, and when I was there, the country was one country. You could travel outside of Sana'a freely. You could see really just amazing parts of the country, meet different people. Yemen is a very diverse country with a welcoming population. So I had the privilege of being there in in more stable times. It certainly had its problems, its political problems, which led to the Arab Spring uprising in 2011, mismanagement.
Well, let me just stop you there, April, because I want to turn it to Stephen Caton. April was talking about the former longtime ruler, ex-President Saleh, who's now allied with this Houthi rebel movement. Saleh, of course, as she mentioned, was forced out during the Arab Spring back in late 2011. I think there was a lot of hope at that time. Tell us just briefly how things have gone since then.
Can I just add one note to what April said? So, and this is in line with the question of journalism. So when the unification took place of the two countries in 1990, there was an actual moment of about 4 or 5 years where there was real press freedom, a very active press, in fact, that was discussing critically all kinds of issues. And there was a moment, in fact, even where Yemen became the kind of poster child for Arab democracy in the world. So what has happened since, and part of that has to do with Ali Abdullah Saleh's authoritarian rule that clamped down on freedoms of the press, what has happened since is really, by virtue of that long-term perspective, really, really tragic how far the country has gone down in far as press freedom and press coverage within the country is concerned. With regard to your specific question of, you know, how things have happened since 2010, there was this very hopeful moment, as with all the other Arab Springs in the Middle East. Ali Abdullah Saleh actually agreed to step down. There was an agreement for his vice president to become the interim ruler of the country, or at least the administrator of the country. And then in a general election, he was made the president. There was a moment for dialogue in the country for the various factions to come together. A new constitution was created. There was hope that Yemen could move forward. But in fact, these structural problems, which are very deep-seated with the Houthis in the north, the southern secessionist movement or tendency to move against with long-term complaints about the north, just wouldn't go away. And then there was also the factor of Saudi Arabia, which is always a factor in Yemen affairs.
And we'll get to that in just a moment. But Christine Beckerly, I wanted to bring you in because you traveled to Yemen earlier this year. It's very difficult, as we heard Sharif say, very difficult for international journalists to travel there now, for human rights groups like Human Rights Watch. Tell us about what you saw there.
Sure. So we had done many trips to Sana'a and areas under Houthi Saleh control since March 2015, when the Saudi Arabia coalition began its military campaign in Yemen after the Houthi Saleh forces took over the capital Sana'a in late 2014. But what we really wanted to do with this last trip was go to Aden and see, you know, what are the human rights violations at play in Aden? What can we document? And what was, I think, very frustrating was that even though Houthi Saleh forces had withdrawn from the southern city a long time ago, there were still real serious problems ongoing. And that was both sort of the after effects of when the Houthi Saleh forces were in the city. So we documented the use of anti-personnel landmines and the continued toll that was taking on the civilian population. But we also looked at what was an increasingly very concerning pattern of violations against people who were being arbitrarily detained, forcibly disappeared, abused, tortured in detention facilities across southern and eastern Yemen. And I think what was very concerning for us at that time was it wasn't just that you had a plethora of different armed groups and security forces that were really operating at this point in the city that led to a whole bunch of confusion and a security vacuum, but also that you had powerful players like the United Arab Emirates playing a significant role in some of these abuses. And so when we were there, we documented many of these abuses and then we came out and reported on it. And I think listening to April and Steve, what's very sort of frustrating as a person following Yemen now is that you look back on these moments of hope and you see the way in which the country has sort of devolved and the way in which the Yemeni civilian population has played an incredible toll throughout this conflict. And you also don't see, even now, zooming to the present, real traction either from the international community or the parties to the conflict on either side to really try and address some of these problems, even when it comes to the simple fact of disappearing fathers, sons, and brothers sort of across the country.
And April Longley Alley, you heard Christine and Steve both talk about the role of outside countries in this conflict. On one level, there's a conflict within Yemen between different groups, between President Hadi and the forces loyal to him, between the Houthis and the former President Saleh. Talk to us about the role of Saudi Arabia and of Iran in this conflict. How much are they sort of just accessories to the conflict, or to what degree are they sort of the key decision makers?
Well, certainly this is a regionalized civil war. And as you mentioned, the conflict started very much as a domestic struggle for power. And then in March 2015, Saudi Arabia intervened on behalf of the Hadi government and a cluster of groups that then came under that umbrella, not necessarily loyal to Hadi, but came under that umbrella of anti-Houthi, anti-Saleh. And that was in 2015, Saudi Arabia put together a coalition of mostly Sunni Arab countries to reinstate Hadi and to push back Houthi Saleh military gains. And the motivation for Saudi Arabia is much less to do with the intricacies of Yemeni politics, but very much connected to its perception of the Iranian threat in Yemen through the Houthis. So they look at the Houthis and see an Iranian proxy. They see a threat of a Hezbollah-like entity on their border. And so they moved in forcefully in March to try to deal with this threat militarily.
Sorry, Hezbollah, of course, is the Iranian-backed militia operating in Lebanon and Syria.
In Lebanon. They view the Houthis in Yemen as an Iranian proxy as well. And so Saudi Arabia enters, and it's also a time when you have a shift in power inside of Saudi Arabia. So Mohammed bin Salman, his star is rising inside of Saudi Arabia, this younger generation of leadership, and they're taking a much more foot-forward, much more aggressive foreign policy stance. And as Steve also mentioned, Yemen, Saudi has always been the major external player in Yemen. They view Yemen as part of their internal security, and they view themselves as the big brother in Yemen. So even without Iran, the Houthis are a deeply anti-American, anti-Saudi group, and so they wouldn't be primary decision maker, or they wouldn't have as much influence if the Houthis were dominant there. Now, of course, the UAE is the main regional partner of Saudi Arabia militarily on the ground. So they entered in the fight as well, and they primarily played a dominant role in South Yemen. Iran plays its role in Yemen is much more murky. Certainly, its support for the Houthis is far, far less than what the Saudi coalition is providing to the anti-Houthi Saleh forces. What we really see is a very low-grade investment by Iran with a high return. So essentially, they're able to provide some amount of military assistance to the Houthis, certainly media support and political support, and they're able to bog Saudi down in the quagmire of Yemen.
A reminder that you're tuned into Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. On today's show, we're talking about the civil war in Yemen that has triggered what one UN official called a humanitarian catastrophe. We're joined by April Longley Alley of the International Crisis Group, Christine Beckerly of Human Rights Watch, and Stephen Caton of Harvard University. If you're interested in more coverage of underreported international and human rights news, visit us at globaljournalist.org. You can also connect with us on Facebook and Twitter, or subscribe to the video cast of this program on YouTube. And Stephen Caton, I wanted to ask you about the role of this affiliate of Al-Qaeda in this conflict. You know, at one time before the rise of ISIS, this Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula was sort of considered the terror group or extremist group, if you will, that posed the largest threat to the United States and to the West. What is their role now, and how are they viewed internationally?
You know, actually, I would defer to April Longley on this question because I'm not an expert and I don't follow these kinds of terrorist links. But I wanted to build on her excellent overview by saying that Saudi Arabia, historically, ever since the first state was established in the 18th century, has been a state that has driven itself outward from Central Arabia to the edges of the Arabian Peninsula. And that drive has manifested itself throughout the 200 plus years that it's been in existence. When I was in Yemen first in the late 1970s, Saudi used its petrodollars really to its influence by paying the salaries of the civil administration in North Yemen. And then gradually it exported a kind of soft power through its Salafi religious groups, which directly threatened Houthi Shia power in the north. And that's one reason that the Houthis had a real problem with the Saudi Salafis. And then finally, this conflict, this relationship has become far more military, partly because of the sense in which I think Saudi Arabia feels, along with the UAE, that there is going to be an eventual military confrontation with Iran, and that it needs to build up its military, and that military needs experience fighting on the ground. And unfortunately, it's chosen Yemen as that battlefield, and one that has proven incredibly difficult for Saudi Arabia and the UAE to win on. In fact, it's a total stalemate. So there's an evolution in this business of Saudi Arabia's involvement in Yemen. It goes way back.
Well, let me turn this to Christine Beckerly, because one feature of this conflict, there's obviously the humanitarian catastrophe, 7 million people on the brink of starvation, 700,000 cases of cholera this year. But I wanted to ask you as well about why the humanitarian situation there is so bad 2 years on. How come there hasn't been sort of an effective independent investigation of some of these abuses that we've been hearing about, the bombings of civilians, bombings of schools by the Saudi coalition, attacks, indiscriminate shelling on civilians by the Houthis, by rebel forces?
So I think the sort of simple answer to that question is that, first of all, there's an ongoing debate happening in Geneva right now at the UN Human Rights Council about whether or not to create an international investigation into all sides Yemen abuses. When you say it like that, and I think at least from my perspective, from Human Rights Watch's perspective, it's not a complicated question. You've got more than 2 years of war with really egregious violations on both sides. So like you said, Saudi-led coalition bombing schools, hospitals, homes. Just in the last 3 months, we documented 6 attacks by the Saudi-led coalition, all of which appear to violate the laws of war, which killed more than 30 children, hit family homes. And what's very frustrating is that is not anything new. It's the same thing we've been documenting since the start of this conflict. Just last week, we documented Houthi Salah forces once again indiscriminately shelling Yemen's third largest city of Taiz, killing 3 children, including 2 who were playing soccer. And the answer to why there isn't an international investigation, when evidence continues to mount about war crimes being committed on both sides, when it's very, very clear that the humanitarian situation isn't happening sort of in a vacuum. It's not something that's inevitable. When the UN talks about the humanitarian catastrophe, they use the term man-made. And when they say that, what they're saying is this war is exacerbating and furthering the humanitarian crisis. And that means both specifically the laws of war violations and human rights violations on both sides, as well as both parties impeding and interfering with the delivery of humanitarian access and aid in a very direct manner. And so why is there not an international investigation? And the answer is Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and their allies have been pushing fiercely against this sort of international scrutiny. And so at the UN now, you have a group of courageous states putting forward a resolution calling for, again, an impartial, independent inquiry. But you have states like the US, the UK, even France, not really getting on board with that call, even though they've done so in other contexts, because they're pushing for, quote unquote, a compromise. But when they say that, what they're really saying is that because they're closely allied with Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, and because Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates do not want this sort of international scrutiny, even when it would bring scrutiny to the very forces they are fighting, they've been pushing hard against this. So our hope is that we'll see in the end of this Human Rights Council session, finally, the establishment of this international inquiry, because I think, as April and Steve have really laid out, there's a myriad of problems that Yemen is dealing with, and this is really a very, very small step that the international community could take to show that it's paying attention and considering.
Well, let me, if I could, you raise some points here that I'd like to hear April Longley Ali address here, and that particularly is the role of the United States, the United Kingdom, to some degree, France here. They're not acting as neutral arbiters in this conflict exactly, are they? Talk to us about the U.S. role.
No, they're not. So I'll make a quick comment on that and then go back to the issue of famine, which we've done quite a bit of work on, the threat of famine. The U.S., the U.K., and France as well have all supported the Saudi-led coalition with armaments. They provided logistical support and also intelligence support. So they are very much part and parcel to this conflict. They've taken sides in the conflict. So
when bombs are being dropped on schools in Yemen, those bombs, you're saying, are bombs that the United States sold or its allies sold to Saudi forces then?
Yes, and this has been the case from the very beginning under the Obama administration. Essentially, the Obama administration had reservations about the war and how it was prosecuted throughout his term, and made that clear in the media occasionally, but consistently supported the Saudi-led coalition, continued to support them with munitions. And essentially, at that time, it was in the context of the Iranian nuclear deal. So they had antagonized their close ally, Saudi Arabia, on the Iranian nuclear deal. And so, in a sense, gave the Yemen file over to Saudi Arabia with very little scrutiny. At the time, many in Saudi Arabia thought it would be a quick war, and now it has dragged on to 2.5 years. Over the course of the Obama administration, you had critique and then some pulling back of support to the coalition, but it was mostly symbolic. Now, under the Trump administration, they have even reinstated some of the precision guiding munitions that were halted or paused under the Obama administration because of concerns over international humanitarian law violations. But those have been reinstated now under the Trump administration.
And Christine Beckerle, our time does grow short, but where do you see this conflict going in the next year, in the next 2 years? Are there reasons for optimism that this stalemate that has caused this massive humanitarian catastrophe may be brought to an end?
Well, I'll quickly just circle back to what Sharif was saying, in that the one thing that gives me optimism in a world in which there's very, very little optimism that I see in terms of Yemen is that you still have these really incredible Yemeni activists, Yemeni journalists, be they inside or outside the country, dealing with incredible challenges, trying to push various solutions or various issues forward and really pushing for at least the protection of their rights even as this conflict drags on. What I think provokes in me less hope is that it shouldn't be that difficult to convince the international community, particularly the Human Rights Council, that they should create an international investigation into a 2+ years conflict that's the world's largest humanitarian catastrophe and has been marred by frequent laws of war violations on all sides. And yet you see this fierce debate, and yet you see this continued protection, as April, I think, laid out well, not really the push we would want to see from the U.S. or other states, given the evidence that has piled up about the use of their own weapons and potential complicity in coalition attacks. So unless you see a shift in the way in which the international community is dealing with the various parties to this conflict, I don't have much room for hope. Other than that, I know very many...
I'm sorry, April. Christine, we'll have to leave it there for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Sharif Mansour, April Longley-Alley, Christine Beck, and Stephen Caton for joining us. Our assistant producers are Jiwon Choi, Waverly Colville, and Sam Lucas, with supervising producer Rachel Foster Gimbel. Kyle Phillip Felling is our audio engineer. Travis McMillan of the Reynolds Journalism Institute is director. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.